Are you John Shannon Marino?
I am.
You're not allowed to have a seat, that's what you're gonna mention, because as you notice from the order, our special term, when a party does not offer a, or does not appear through council, for one thing, we don't have an oral argument, and if it doesn't respond at all, then we just simply proceed on the briefing and the comments of council today by the party that does. So you're welcome to have a seat in the back, of course, and listen to the proceeding. Thank you. And now we have counsel for appellant at the appellant table. And as you noted, if you were observing previously, the podium in the middle does have the clock on it, so it's a little more convenient. Does have the button if you want to adjust. And when you begin your statement, if you would identify yourself for the record, then you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ruta Johnson, and I am appearing here today on behalf of appellant Casey Bale, who is present in the courtroom today. Appellant respectfully requests this court to
clarify, you pronounce that Bale. I think I mispronounced it. Is that correct, Bale? Okay, very good.
Yes, that's correct. As I was saying, appellant respectfully requests this court to reverse district court's award of joint legal custody and remand for an award of sole legal custody to the appellant. The issues before this court today are much like dominoes. As soon as the court erroneously found that the evidence in the record is not sufficient to conclude that domestic abuse has occurred, the first domino fell, and it led to a chain link of errors. No domestic abuse finding led to the application of a rebuttable presumption that joint legal custody is in the best interest of the minor child, which led to a finding that Ms. Bale, who was the respondent in the district court matter, did not rebut the presumption, which led to the court's failure to consider the nature, context, impact of abuse on the minor child, which then led to the improper award of joint legal custody to the parties. This court.
So, Ms. Johnson, so in looking at finding nine, you know, it seems like the district court focused on the harassing text messages and belittling and yelling, but then did not address some of the testimony that was presented about, you know, push me, biting my ear, hit me with a pillow. So is it your position that it was clearly erroneous because that evidence, which was unrebutted and is not discussed in finding nine, indicates that there was domestic assault?
If I understand your question correctly, yes. Part of the issue was that there was a lot of evidence presented to the court that supported a finding of domestic abuse under 518B01. And what the court did is not only did our district court not address any of that evidence that was presented, it was as if it didn't exist.
And but why wouldn't we assume, you know, there's that testimony in the record, but why would we assume that the court didn't believe that either? And that therefore, you know, made a credibility finding which we cannot revisit on appeal. Why wouldn't we make the assumption that the court didn't address it because it didn't believe your client after hearing the testimony?
Your Honor, from my perspective, I believe that these were very significant events that were presented to the court by the appellant, that were presented to the court by the custody evaluator, by the therapist, and we don't know whether the court missed this evidence, whether the court didn't believe this evidence. There are no credibility determinations addressed in the order whatsoever, so we can't really glean anything from that, what the court believed or didn't believe. To me, the court's discussion in that finding nine that Your Honor mentioned really focuses on verbal abuse, and so it communicates that the court did notice that there was something that was presented but really missed some key factors. And I believe part of the issue was We had a robust record. For example, custody evaluator's file was submitted to the court as Exhibit 101, and the stack was pretty significant. A lot of the information that was available to the court was included in that record, and maybe it was addressed in testimony, but not extensively, so that we're not presenting cumulative evidence. My impression is that the court perhaps missed it.
Ms. Johnson, on that point, not on the missed point, but as you were leading up to that, isn't it true that, and as I understand the trial, Mr. Marino was not represented, and he went first and didn't talk about the allegations that your client then later made, and there was no opportunity for rebuttal, but there was documents, I can't remember if it was the counselor, therapist, or evaluators, but in there is where Mr. Marino's denial, essentially, because those same allegations came up. Am I correct about that? So the judge had that information as well.
The judge did have that information. So the domestic abuse allegation didn't pop up out of nowhere at trial. It was extensively discussed in events leading up to trial, which was the social early neutral evaluation and the facilitated settlement conference that the parties participated in.
But I was focusing on, and Judge Colley made a good point, there was no testimony contrary to it, but because of the structure and the fact perhaps that he was unrepresented, it just kind of went that way. But the fact is the judge had the allegation it happened and it didn't happen. Isn't that our normal scenario, absent the live testimony portion of it, that we will imply, obviously, credibility findings, or one could look at it one of two ways, either your client's allegation isn't credible, or the point being is they both are credible, but that's a 50-50 scenario, so I can't apply the presumption, which is what the judge did in finding 9. Would that be a fair characterization, at least the evidence that led up to that?
Yes, for the most part. I will note that although Mr. Marino was unrepresented and he was the petitioner who went first, he did anticipate the issues of domestic abuse coming up as evidenced by him presenting his ex-wife, who also had domestic abuse allegations in the past against him, as a character witness, for a lack of a better characterization there, to show that maybe she wasn't credible when she had reported, and because they could work together, then Ms. Bale and Mr. Marino could also work together. So he anticipated that that was going to happen. He had the ability to rebut. He had the ability to cross-examine Ms. Bale. He didn't ask the court for the opportunity to offer any rebuttal evidence or testimony at the end of the trial, which I believe the court would have allowed to do, as it would be fairly standard. What was important is that Mr. Marino, all that Mr. Marino presented as evidence on his behalf with domestic abuse was a denial. He didn't present any recordings that would characterize the party's relationship in a different light than what Ms. Bale was presenting. And again, the custody evaluator had completed an extensive investigation of what had went on in the party's relationship. There were interviews with collateral sources, including Mr. Marino's ex-wife. There were interviews with the party's family therapist who reported concerning abusive behavior that they had observed. Ms. Bale's therapist reported to the custody evaluator, which is included in the record, again, that he saw the parties after the incident where Mr. Marino had woken up in the middle of the night, threatened essentially Ms. Bale with a baby monitor as if he was going to hit her with it, then threw the baby monitor, proceeded to hit her with a very heavy pillow to the point where she could not get off the ground and crawled away to hide in a closet, where she then proceeded to attempt a 911 call, but was disrupted by Mr. Marino's threats that if she completed that call, he would take the child and run away, essentially, never to be seen again. So after this incident, the party saw their therapist.
Can I stop you? Because we're not a fact-finding court, and I feel like you're asking us to make factual findings here. I see that you moved for amended findings after the district court issued its order.
We did.
And the district court denied amended findings.
Correct.
In your request for amended findings, did you raise the issue of the district court failing to make an express credibility determination and ask the district court to address how it resolved the competing testimony?
Your Honor, I do not recall off the top of my head if we asked the court to correct the credibility determination issue.
Is that what I hear you saying? I mean, we defer to credibility determinations, implicit or explicit. And you've argued earlier, I believe, that, well, we don't have an explicit credibility determination, so we shouldn't give any deference. Well, why shouldn't we give deference to the implied credibility determination, which we normally do when you had an opportunity to raise the lack of an express credibility determination in your request for amended findings and either did not do so or the district court rejected it? I'm just having a hard time understanding why we would be permitted to reach a different conclusion regarding the existence of domestic abuse or not in this case when it was tried to the court and the court's order implies that it did not believe those allegations.
Your Honor, in terms of credibility determinations, like I said, there are none. And even if we're looking at the implicit credibility determinations, we could conclude that all of the witnesses that testified were found to be credible by the court, especially when the court gave so much deference to the custody evaluator in terms of his recommendations.
If the court thought they were all credible, that means the court would have found domestic abuse and would have ordered something else.
From the court's order, it is unclear whether the court considered the acts of domestic abuse that were reported to the court at the time of trial.
And you had an opportunity to raise that omission in the context of a motion for amended findings, which is where it should be raised because we can't retry the case here. I mean, the purpose of amended findings is to give the court an opportunity to correct any errors.
Yes, Your Honor. And in terms of the issue of the missing discussion of the Domestic Abuse Act, we did raise those issues. And the court issued a fairly short order after the motion for amended findings that basically said, I reviewed all of the underlying evidence and I'm not going to change my mind. We're going to stay with the joint custody.
But doesn't that tell us the district court was presented with the possibility that it had misweighed or misjudged those allegations and was given an opportunity to do something different and did not do so, which is all the more reason for us not to second guess the fact finder who had the ability to sit in trial, hear the witness testimony firsthand, see the witnesses, see their interactions, and make some tough judgments about what actually happened, which is what fact finders have to do in these cases, and which is why we don't substitute our view of the evidence for that of the fact finder.
Your Honor, we are not asking this court to retry the case. In looking at the standard of review, when an issue turns on the district court's finding of facts, this court gives deference. That is absolutely accurate.
Unless those findings are clearly erroneous.
Correct.
But I know there was this audio recording, but, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, the audio recording would not demonstrate, you know, that your client was hit with a pillow or hit at all. I mean, it'd be one thing. I mean, I would have a better appreciation for the argument if, you know, if there's a video showing him hitting her.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, the court didn't discuss that. That looks like domestic abuse to me. Clearly, then, I mean, I suppose we'd have to send it back to say, so what do you think of this? But if we don't have that, and most of it is based on her testimony, then I think it's more along the lines of what Judge Larkin is talking about, where, you know, it's hard for us to say that it was clearly erroneous not to discuss the hitting and assault when we can assume that the district court, based on credibility determinations, didn't believe the testimony of these people who were talking.
Your Honor, under the Domestic Abuse Act 518B, when we're talking about the definitions of domestic abuse, Subdivision 2 talks about the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. There were two audio recordings that were introduced where the appellant is heard stating, I'm scared. You're acting like you're going to hit me. You're in my face. You're yelling at me. You're spitting at me. from the court reviewing those records, that the conclusion that an act of domestic abuse took place in these instances could have been made. Now, I understand that this court is not going to reverse just because a different outcome is possible. But when looking at the totality of circumstances and looking at all of the other evidence that was presented, and again, it wasn't just testimony. There were reports, the custody evaluators, file was included with extensive investigation notes, and the custody evaluators specifically testified to the court that from their perspective and their investigation, based on all of the collateral contacts, based on all of the review of the records, the domestic abuse did occur.
Ms. Johnson, I know you're running out of time, so if you need to go over, you probably will to finish answering my question, you're certainly welcome. Let's presume, in any event, we agree with you that the record does not support a failure to find a rebuttable presumption. How do you win in that case, despite the fact it's simply a presumption that's not difficult to rebut? In the Thornton case, you know, confirm that. And in fact, in the Thornton case, the child can, if there was returned to the abuser, as I recall, under the underlying domestic abuse. And here we've got findings that the court made that they can, on the major decisions, that they are able to, they've been able to do it using our family wizard and will continue to do so. And in fact, the custody evaluator, despite believing domestic abuse, recommended joint legal. So it's supported in the record. How do you get past that, even if we agree with you on to find anything other than a harmless error, if there is an error?
Certainly. So if the court would have found that domestic abuse did occur, then the presumption that joint legal custody is not in the child's best interest would have applied. And in that case, the court was required to analyze additional factors. So the context of the abuse, the effect of the abuse on the child, and the child's well-being, and look at how that impacts the party's ability to make joint decisions in the future. The Thornton case, I think, is really interesting and on point here because at the district court level in Thornton, there was a lot of discussion in terms of the victim of domestic abuse in that case weaponizing the child and the coercive control that was happening in terms of how the parties are going to be able to make those future decisions. What's different about this case from Thornton is that in Thornton, the district court went through a detailed analysis of all of those factors and then made a decision to award sole legal custody to the perpetrator of abuse in that case. In our case, there's no analysis. There is no discussion about the presumption of joint legal custody not being in the child's best interest. And further, what I also think is critical in this piece, Thornton talks about shifting the burden or applying the burden to overcome the presumption to a certain party. And where Thornton comes out is to say that it's not up to a party to rebut the presumption. It's the evidence in the record, and it's neither party's obligation to overcome it. And so the court, again, did not engage in any analysis of that. I understand, and I do know that I've run out of time, I understand that the custody evaluator issued a recommendation for joint legal custody. What was important about that recommendation is that the custody evaluator was very clear during his testimony at trial that this recommendation was at the time of the facilitated settlement conference that was 6 months before the trial actually took place. And because the court did not order or excuse the custody evaluator from submitting a report, an updated recommendation was not possible.
But did the evaluator change his opinion during the testimony?
He did not. He was very clear in that.
Did anything happen in that 6 month period on which you're basing allegations of domestic abuse?
Not domestic abuse during the 6 month period, but the recommendations that the psychological evaluation had were clear that there were a number of services that the parties were supposed to engage in, and it was crucial for success for joint legal custody that those recommendations are being followed. At the time of the trial, Mr. Marino did not present any evidence that he was engaging and following those recommendations. That was the expectation that recommendations would be followed was very clear from the custody evaluator, who did say, well, you know, as the wind blew that day, that is why we decided to recommend joint legal custody. The custody evaluator did not complete the report and did not have an opportunity to see which way the wind would blow at the time of writing the report and how the parties actually implemented the OFW and their communication plan and the failures during those 6 months that we just didn't have an opportunity. And one of the other things that I want to mention, with the understanding that I am completely out of time, is custody evaluator didn't recommend complete joint legal custody. What the custody evaluator recommended is joint custody for medical and religious, but that Ms. Bale should have sole decision-making authority for education because there were already areas of dispute and concern.
Is there a basis in the statute for such a recommendation?
Custody evaluators, in my experience, have recommended a hybrid model.
Well, actually, I rephrased it. I understand your point. That was recommended, but there's no basis for a judge to split legal custody in such a manner. That
not by reading of the statute.
Okay. Very well. Thank you for your additional comments and answers to our questions in the briefing. And so the parties are aware, we will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days.
Thank you.
That concludes our oral calendar today. We'll be adjourning and considering our non-oral matter.
All right.
Have a good day.